Welcome to Suit Yourself, the podcast of the Irish Surgical Training Group, the ISTG, hosted by Sinead Ramjet, Fintan Ryan, and me, Vinny Riley.
Whether you're a medical student, a curious listener, or a seasoned surgeon, we hope to provide content that will help develop your knowledge, interest, and understanding of common surgical topics.
We would like to emphasize that the information presented in this podcast is for educational purposes only, and is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Let's introduce, I'm with Prof. Calvin Coffey here, who is the head of school at University of Limerick and professor of surgery here at the Sylvester O'Halloran 2024 Symposium. Thanks very much for joining us, Prof. Coffey. We're on day one of the conference here today and it's going really well. I'm part of the vascular masterclass and there's a whole range. And just very briefly, do you want to tell us a little bit about the history of maybe Sylvester O'Halloran himself, as well as how this conference came about and how you've been involved with it?
Okay. So there's really nothing brief in all that, really, unfortunately.
Please take your time.
All right. Sylvester O'Halloran was a surgeon in the Midwestern region. He was born in 1728 and died in 1807. This year is his 296th anniversary. And I think in 2028, we have his 300th anniversary. So we're going back a good bit of time. He was an innovator. He was a pioneer. And the reason that we call this the Sylvester O'Halloran lecture meeting is in honor of him. He was the person responsible for suggesting that a school of surgery be set up in 1765. And he recommended that a school of surgery along the lines of the school that was in Paris at the time be set up in Ireland, because there was no formal institute of surgical education in there.
Had he trained in Paris at that time, or had he just read or heard? Or
he had trained in Paris, spent some years in Paris. I'm not sure how many. Had spent some years elsewhere on mainland Europe as well, and then came back to Ireland, to Limerick, in fact.
Okay.
Yeah. So he recommended it, and he published in 1765. And his recommendation was at the back of one of his publications back then, almost like an addendum, that there should be an institute of education, surgical education. And it was on the back of that, four guys got together then in Dublin. Okay. And I can't remember their specific names, but they then set up a group that would teach or would educate in surgery. And then that then morphed into the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. And I think the first formal meeting of the Royal College of Surgeons was about 1784. Okay. And in honour and recognition of Sylvester O'Halloran then, my understanding is they conferred him with a diploma, and he received that diploma in 1786. And we actually have a copy of the original diploma that he would have carried around with him.
Yeah. And did he always practice in this Limerick area?
To the best of my knowledge, he did. As I said, he trained to a degree in mainland Europe, and then most of his life was spent practicing here in Limerick, actually. He would have been a generalist, managing a lot of trauma.
Yeah.
There was a lot of trauma in the region at the time. Had an interest in ophthalmic surgery and an interest in head injuries as well. And he's published a lot. Published a huge amount, really, for that time.
Absolutely. And I suppose then the conference has been running for a number of years.
30. No, actually more than 30. Started in 1992.
Yeah.
And it was a surgeon in the Limerick, in the region, called Peter Delaney, set it up. I don't know why he set it up. And he also set up a lot of other things in the region as well, which were really visionary and pioneering when you think about it. He set up a postgraduate education centre here.
Okay.
And he also set up he was a founding member of a thing called the Trust. And the Trust administers philanthropic funding from a number of different sources in the region. So a lot of the buildings that you see around here were built on capital funding obtained from the trust. So, but for Peter Delaney, a lot of the stuff that you see around here, buildings would not have been built. The postgraduate centre would not have been built, and you wouldn't have Sylvester Halloran Meehan.
It's really driving forward with kind of both surgical education, medical education, and research, I imagine, as well. And
absolutely.
Dating back from Sylvester Halloran, he's always been a pioneer in pushing research innovation from foundations of colleges. What other innovations and research has happened in Limerick, maybe that you've been involved in over the last few decades?
Where do you start? So I suppose I started here in 2010, and we've kind of tried to innovate in clinical practice. We've tried to innovate in research, and we've tried to innovate in the Sylvester meeting itself.
Yeah.
And if I talk about the meeting, it's, I suppose, first, since 2014, we've gone from an abstract submission rate of about 80 abstracts submitted per year up to in and around 400. It's a huge number.
Yeah.
We've about a 40% rejection rate, unfortunately, at the moment, because the number is so huge.
Yeah.
But that has been, that's one massive change that has occurred. Other changes in terms of the meeting, we've made a load of change. We call it a perioperative meeting rather than a surgical meeting. I think that's really important, and I think particularly for your generation coming through, we tend to forget and we tend to ignore nursing, when nursing is probably the single largest component of care, of surgical care. And we all get caught up in our own self-importance as surgeons in the whole process. And so we wanted to correct that imbalance, and we wanted to bring nursing into it. So we call it the perioperative symposium rather than just surgical symposium. And at the moment, you've got the nursing masterclasses, which is one of the fullest rooms that you'll see over the coming 3 days.
Absolutely. It's just beside us down in Vascular. And it's huge. And it's great, even for those of us that have worked in Limerick or have worked in Limerick. It's a social and professional thing that we're all working within theatres, outside of theatres, and also in a sort of that we're everyone's...
Often too social.
We try.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, and I wonder, is there any advice that you may have, just while we're talking about abstracts, to students, trainees, both for this meeting, but also for the wider thing of getting involved with research, writing abstracts, presentations and publications?
Yeah. So I suppose there's an awful lot of work goes into research. And if you take, there's been 4,029 abstracts submitted to the Sylvester Halloran ever since the start of 1992. That's a huge number. And then it becomes an even bigger number when you consider consider the physical effort that was put into generating the research for each abstract.
Yeah.
Often you have PhDs, 3-4 year long PhDs involved. And then there's a lot of effort involved in writing the abstract, getting your presentation ready, presenting it to your boss, going through all of that kind of stuff, and then getting to the meeting, presenting it. There's a big, huge emotional factor involved in all of that. If you feel that you're in for a prize, it's all great. But then if you don't get it, it's disappointing. There's an emotional element to that as well. And then going back to after having maybe been grilled sometimes in questions and things like that, you know, sometimes it can be a fairly daunting experience. So if you multiply all of that across 4,029 abstracts over 30 meetings, it's a vast body of human effort. What advice I'd give people? Do a project that is relevant. I think we lost our way in terms of surgical research when we became too molecular.
Yeah.
And we moved away from what is fundamental to surgery, and that is anatomy, the core basics.
Yeah.
And it became a rare event that we actually were talking about the foundation of surgery and what we actually technically do. And I think that we need to go back to that. I would advise people, do research that is going to be relevant to you and that ultimately will influence clinical practice. I think that's, and it's not hard to do that, you know, it's not hard to do that at all. I do that. I would also advise people, when you're doing research, to not get disheartened with negative results, because negative results are still results. And often it's the interpretation of those negative results that actually leads you to some kind of a eureka moment where you go, hey, look at this, and we can conclude from these negative results that this is the case. And often those kind of conclusions are very much the ones that really stand out and have an impact on patient care. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how you'd synopsize all that, but that would be...
Yeah, and I think it's very true. Some of the trainee does retrace as well. Like, we're surgeons, that's what we've been trained to do, and then we suddenly switch to being asked to go to a lab, and it's not our comfortable space. When, like, if you look at registered OCTs in the UK and Ireland at the moment, less than 5% of them are surgical-based.
Yeah.
It's very hard to do randomised trials.
Yeah.
Have you been involved in any surgical trials that you think have worked well? What has worked well?
Yeah, I have. We've been involved in a number of them, but it's so hard, it's almost prohibitive.
Yeah.
And it really is very hard. And nowadays, the logistics involved that make it even more difficult. GDPR and the various repairs, other ethical requirements often make it even more challenging. But we've published a lot in different clinical trials over the last decade, and we have work that is, so for example, our work in Crohn's disease is influencing clinical practice.
Yeah.
Our work in congenital abnormalities is influencing clinical practice. Our work in anatomy, although it's not a clinical trial, well, you could call it cohort-based clinical trials. That work is now curriculum in Gray's Anatomy.
Yeah.
And that is essentially the foundation, the anatomical foundation of everything we do in the abdomen. So that's impactful work, and it's clinically relevant. And it comes back to the fact that try at all costs to do clinically relevant stuff.
Yeah. And I suppose when we get given the pyramid and the hierarchy, it's obviously so difficult to do randomized trials that maybe in surgery it's the clinically relevant research is more important than anything else, as opposed to molecular randomized trials. And that's what we need to disseminate in these meetings as well.
Everybody always comes back to the example of cholecystectomy. There's never been a randomized controlled trial of, is it lap versus open cholecystectomy or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And yet laparoscopic cholecystectomy is standard practice. Our work in Crohn's disease wasn't a randomized controlled trial. It was a retrospective cohort-based analysis. Still a kind of a trial, but retrospective. And that has led on to a lot of different investigations in the setting of Crohn's disease. So it doesn't have to be your top-end RCT.
Yeah.
It can be very, very basic cohort-based stuff, and it can still be very impactful.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any, I suppose, from the meeting that we're at the moment, is there any results or any findings or any standout presentations that you can think of over the last number of decades that really stand out to you as like, really, I think that this has changed and it came here at the meeting?
Yeah. If you talk about the meeting that we have this week, there's a strong emphasis on robotics. Definitely robotic platforms have transformed the surgical landscape. You have to kind of think, well, how did they do this? And like, if you think about it, we were all, prior to robotics and prior to minimally invasive surgery, we had our hands in the abdomen, our hands in the cavity, our hands on. Okay. With minimally invasive, you had an instrument between you and the tissue you were operating on. And now with robotic, you're sitting in the corner and the patient and the platform is elsewhere. So like, you are now separated by at least 2 degrees from the patient. You're entirely separate from the patient. So the operative, the platform, how we do it, has now transformed completely, and you're going to see a lot of robotics and talk about robotics in this meeting. Some people still have their head in the sand and kind of say, well, you know what, robotics will eventually go away. It won't. I mean, it's definitely here to stay, and it's going to be consolidated. AI is definitely here to stay as well. A lot of people talking about AI and not using it, and you know that really is frustrating when they put themselves out there as experts of AI and they don't even use it. But we've started using AI here, we've started programming it here, and the illustrations you saw there were generated with AI from CT scans. It is incredibly powerful.
So incredibly powerful. Briefly, what's your experience with using kind of either metadata or AI, the broad term you've been using?
Well, firstly, AI isn't AI. That's an important thing to acknowledge, you know, that it isn't artificial intelligence. But the AI-based tools that are out there, okay? Yeah. So We've used those. We programmed our own AI-based tools, and it's not a hard thing to do. If we can do it, anybody can do it, I can tell you.
Yeah.
You need a little bit of computer programming, a little bit only, and you can actually do it.
Yeah.
And we've been able to take CT scans from patients that we're about to operate on, and we can generate, using the AI-based tools, complete digital models of the abdomen. And I mean, not just all of the, you know, the viscera that we already see. I'm talking about everything, the soft tissue, the connective tissue, the nerves, the vessels, the ureters, the everything. And we can actually, we could take a CAT scan of your abdomen and we could digitally reconstruct your contents to the, literally to a millimeter using the AI-based tools. They're that powerful. And you can then say, look, you know, now that we can, I could digitize you, your abdomen, okay. Bit of an uncomfortable concept when you think about it. Okay.
3D print me after.
Yeah. 3D print you, your contents and your organization.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of like, I mean, weird as an uncomfortable notion, isn't it?
Yeah.
And now we have robotic platforms. It's not a huge leap of the imagination to think that we'll be applying robotic platforms to these digitalizations to do whatever.
Yeah.
And it's not far off.
And that is, obviously, it feels like a jump, but when you break it down to the individual steps, we're not that far.
It's in line of sight.
And how that's going to have an impact on both patient care, and I suppose from my perspective, from your perspective, for training is massive.
Mm.
As we get closer to an area where there's, I suppose, a lot of trainees where maybe there won't be as many operations that we see very commonly, whether that becomes we use these simulations for open surgery that we don't do anymore.
Mm.
Do you think that's going to be as big as a big part of it in the future?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like, definitely. And I could see a situation arise where, now this is probably, well, I don't know if it's well into the future or in the near future, where an automated platform like uses a digitization of the patient and then is performing an autonomous operation. And the insurance companies say, well, we think that's more reliable than the human. And we're going to insure the hospital that uses that platform, and we're not going to insure the surgeon. Yeah. Now, think about that. Now the surgeon can't get insured. You can't. You don't operate.
Yeah.
And now you have a scenario where you have platforms operating autonomously, whereas the surgeon is no longer insurable.
Yeah.
Where do you go there?
Need a new job. Yeah, you go. But it's but yeah, as I said, I think that comes back to your previous point that people who have said, look, technological advances, digital transformation, AI is not coming, have their head in their sand. They need to look at it, learn about it, embrace it, and then work with it.
Yeah.
Which it sounds like you're...
It's not hard.
No.
I mean, people have the idea that it's a big impenetrable edifice of technology. I mean, the technology you're using there, the AI-based editing, is once you start to get into it and start using it, it's very intuitive. And it is definitely something that we say to our surgical trainees here, you've got to learn, you've got to embrace it. It's coming down the tracks. And if you're the person who can take a CAT scan of your patient, put it into the AI, re-digitize the tumor and all the organs around it within a matter of seconds, which we can do now, then you're going to have a better understanding of the anatomical landscape you're going to be operating on.
Yeah.
And if you're the trainee who has the ability to do that, then you're going to be a much better surgeon than you would be if you were going into it blindly.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt.
So talking about the future, but into more maybe real terms of what's in the future for both the conference and then you both professionally, kind of from a surgical research perspective.
Yeah. Okay, so for the conference, we've gone to accepting about 220 abstracts since we began in 1992 up to where we are now in 2024. You have to break down the conference to the multiple components. So let's say sponsorship might be one component, and industry and industry support. I think across the board, you're seeing a decrease in industry support across the board in conferences all over the world.
Yeah.
And I think that is problematic, because without industry and without industry support, you might know it, but this meeting wouldn't occur.
Yeah.
And I don't say that just to generate more support. It's not that. I say that because it's a reality. And We are critically dependent on sponsorship from industry to provide us with revenues that basically allow us to actually set up the meeting and hold the meeting.
Yeah.
Industries are definitely dropping off in terms of their support of surgical meetings. And I think the fundamental reason for that is because of a perception amongst industry that there's no longer markets for many of their technologies, whilst there is markets for robotic platforms.
Yeah.
So people, let's say, might come along with a superb stapling device, but they're up against the robotic platform stapling device. And companies then, as a result, feel, well, look, you know, we don't have any role in this, but we're out of this market.
Yeah.
And if they have a sense they're out of the market, they can't compete, and then they'll fall off. Their support will fall off. So I think until we're back into a situation where you have multiple players in the market competing with each other, like different robotic platforms, for example,
yeah.
Unless there's multiple different robotic platforms competing with each other, sponsorship is going to slowly fall off in multiple meetings. Yeah. And it needs to be, that needs to be addressed. In terms of research going forward, I think we're going to become more surgical in the research.
Yeah.
I think we're going to move away from the molecular.
Do you have anything on the horizon yourself of research?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, tons of it.
Yeah.
We presented last year. We basically digitally reconstructed patients preoperatively and postoperatively, and we were able to show that we actually achieved, technically, anatomically achieved what we said we achieved.
Yeah.
And then you could look at your outcome. You could actually look at the tangible outcome, albeit in a digital format. So that's going to transform. Like, if you look at most papers nowadays, they're all tables of data and figures and, you know,
yeah,
complication rates, hematoma rates, all this and that. This is a new parameter.
Yeah.
Where's your digital model showing what you did?
Yeah.
You know, prove, tell me you did, you achieved what you said you achieved.
Yeah.
We can now do that. And I think surgical research is going to move in that direction.
Do you think that's very applicable for oncological resections or?
Absolutely. Everything.
Yeah.
Everything, sure. Absolutely. I mean, what's your particular area of interest?
Vascular.
So you take that. Vascular lends itself to digital reconstruction because of the contrast, because of the, yeah, you know, it's, you can have a vascular reconstitute in less than a few seconds.
Yeah.
But what vascular don't seem to be doing is digitally reconstructing after the event and showing what you achieved.
Yeah.
You know, in the context of everything else, you know.
There's some new technology now where we will insert our e-bar or our stent.
Yeah.
And we will get an immediate feedback of, we predict this and this will fail within 6 months. You, yeah, need to.
Yeah.
And, but again, for these kind of models to work, much like yourself, you need to input a lot into them.
Yeah.
For it to get more out of it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And what we have found is that you do need to educate it. You need to train these things. And there's a lot of manual curating goes into the training.
Yeah.
And even at the end of the day, when you've got data sets that contain thousands of templates, you're still going to have to manually curate it at the end of the day because it won't ever be absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
So they'll be good, but they'll never be perfect.
Absolutely. So I suppose I'm delighted that we got to have a chat, and
yep,
it's exciting meeting everything going from there. I suppose for trainees, students, anyone listening there, that you don't have to jump straight in to be able to create a 1,000-patient multi-AI platform. But I think research is a pillar of what we do as trainees and surgeons. Getting started early, get it early and often were the things I was told for research and postgraduate exams.
Yeah,
do them early and do them often, and
yeah,
and it gets easier, and then suddenly an MD is not far away, and original research is not far away.
Yeah,
but was that advice that you would give, or do you have anything else that you would add as both a supervisor for someone who says I want to get involved in research?
I would say all of that. I would also say that you need to do things yourself. I would say don't be reliant on others in any manner whatsoever, because you'll flounder on that rock. Because until it's people will only, you know, really come back and help you if it is, you know, it has an impact on them. And so I would say get to do things yourself.
Yeah.
So for here, for example, we tell all the trainees, we're trying to educate them in digitalization of digital processes. Again, coming back to yours, you have a proficiency now in audio editing on using AI-based, the cloud-based tools.
Yeah.
Okay. That's an example of that kind of a proficiency that I think is really, it's totally accessible to people. They shouldn't be afraid of it. And they can do beautiful audio editing, visual editing, illustrative editing, films, and all of this kind of stuff, you know. Yeah. So there's a whole suite of digital tools out there that are dead easy to master, and they will transform your work if you do master it. The other thing I'd say is, with regards to writing, it's a critical component. Just write. Doesn't matter, you know, if it's backwards or what, just get something down. You'll always be able to edit it afterwards. That's what I say in regards to that. In regards to findings and data, don't go looking for the weird and wonderful and the brilliant. The mundane negative results are fantastic. You know, they allow you to make to infer conclusions from them, and often it's just that inferring process that's the real discovery process. And I think that's something that's often forgotten as well.
Brilliant. Well, again, thanks so much for the time, and I hope the meeting keeps going as well as it started.
You're very welcome.
Fantastic.
All right.
If you found this podcast informative and engaging, we would greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to subscribe and share your thoughts by leaving a review on the platform you're listening to.
Our podcast is dedicated to improving valuable insights to surgical trainees, enabling you to stay well-informed about prevalent surgical presentations.
Should you have any inquiries or wish to connect, please don't hesitate to contact us at podcast@istg.ie. Many thanks for listening.
Until we meet again, stay curious, stay informed, and of course, stay sharp.